Good afternoon. We just made it. All right, just made the cut. I was going to say, I'm from Oregon, and so it's just now lunchtime. I was going to say good morning, but still running on that time a little bit. Hey, there are a handful of things in the back. Would you help pass some of those out? Everybody can have one of each of those. But hopefully you're in the right place. You are here for really safeguard and stewardship, just thinking through how do we prevent abuse with kids in our church specifically. So let's get started. My name is Jeremy Heron, and I oversee family ministries. I'm a family ministry pastor at a church in Bend, Oregon called Eastmont. I've been in ministry for the past decade, and I'm now the executive director over ECAP, which is Evangelical Council for Abuse Prevention. It's a lot easier to say ECAP. And so what we're going to do today is really kind of lay out the reason that we need to protect our kids and ways that we often miss these steps. And so I want to talk through that. Then we'll do that for about 30 minutes, and then we'll do a Q&A. And so I want to be able to, y'all be thinking of questions that you have that can apply directly to your church. They can be a much broader question. Nothing I'm afraid of at this point in these conversations. And so I'm glad you're here, though. Glad you're here. So let's dive right in. When we're talking through abuse prevention, especially through our youth serving ministries, I want to make sure that we have our definitions in the right place. I think that's so important when we're having these conversations. And so when we define abuse, that's just any sort of, it can be neglect, but it's any sort of trauma that you're bringing or that has been brought to a child. And there's spiritual abuse, there's physical abuse, there's sexual abuse, there's different kinds of abuse, but we're just going to broadly use that term here. Primarily, when we're talking about this, we're also going to be talking about sexual abuse. And then minors, that's really anybody under 18. You'll hear me say kids a lot. You can go ahead and apply that to youth as well. I'm going to use those pretty interchangeably. So the majority of what we're going to talk about today is going to be for just anybody under 18. We'll get into a few specifics that are more of, hey, this is a diapering policy versus the restroom policy for youth. Those things will be different. But generally speaking, minors are just anybody under 18. Child protection programs. So these are policies, procedures that your church or your organization has created in order to keep kids safe. These are things that we do, things that we don't do, and also things that we would do if a situation were to arise. Things like responding to abuse. And so we're going to go through all of that. And then workers, paid or unpaid. Right, so think through child care volunteers during an event that you might have at your church. This is workers, so your Sunday school teachers. This is youth workers, volunteers. This could even be youth workers that are under 18 who are maybe helping in a kids ministry. And it goes all the way to staff and pastors. Workers is going to be this broad term that incorporates anybody who serves with a minor. Okay, so really quick, high-level definitions. Before we can really get into how do we solve the problem, we have to know what the problem is. And so we see here that it's 1 in 3 girls is going to be sexually assaulted before they're 18. 1 in 7 boys is going to be sexually assaulted before they're 18. So that's 1 in 5 kids on average. And so when you think through your church, and you think your church, if it has a population of 100, that's 20 people in your church that likely, statistically, have been abused. That's what we're trying to put ourselves out of business. We would love to be out of business because we've protected kids. But when you think through that from even a pastoral or ministry mindset, and you start diving into this, just be aware that 20% of your population statistically has gone through something like that. And I'll tell you, my favorite moments as a pastor, when I'm onboarding a volunteer and we're going through all these steps that, people say, oh, you have to jump through all these hoops to serve in kids ministry. Well, it's not just hoops. These are steps we're going to take to make sure that the right people are serving with our kids. But one of my favorite conversations that I get to have routinely is somebody who sits across from me and hears all the things that we do to protect kids. And they just look at me and they say, hey, I'm so glad that this is what we do at this church, because that's my story and I want to make sure it's not somebody else's story. Like, that's a heartbreaking moment. And the only thing you can do is really just cry with them and then pray with them, thank them for coming and being part of the ministry, and then just go. Let's get after this and go. Not only protect kids, but also we want to share the gospel with them. We just want to do it in a way that is in a safe environment for them to hear the gospel. So that's 30% of cases of abuse that never are reported. That is wildly high to me. But I think that number, the more that we have this conversation, the more that number should drop down, because we take the taboo out of the conversation and we say, hey, we're going to have this conversation, and it allows people to speak up and say, that is my story. And so we want to encourage the conversation and not leave it in the shadows. We're going to bring light to a dark place. And then you see this 28% of U.S. youth between as teens, really, have been sexually victimized. In addition to that, 93% of abuse is done with somebody who's known. So how many of y'all grew up with the stranger danger mentality? I did, right? Don't talk to strangers. I tell my kids, talk to strangers. Go for it, as long as I'm with you, right? I need you to know how to talk to people and how to have a conversation. But stranger danger, 7% is somebody who is unknown. 93% of the time is going to be somebody who knows the kid and the kid knows them, whether that's a family member, 34% of the time, or an acquaintance, 58% of the time. That's going to be your Sunday school teacher, things like that. And so really the question that arises from this slide, like naturally in your head, you're asking this question of like, wait, so if 93% of people are known, then how do we make sure that we still have good volunteers? How do I tell the difference between the two? Here, and the easy answer, and I think we get into this in another slide, but the easy answer to that question is when you have a kid who sits on the side of the playground while everyone else plays and they just look sad, a really good volunteer will go over, talk to them for just a second, and push them back into the crowd. Somebody who's out to harm that kid sees the one on the fringe and goes over and sits and tries to be their friend, not push them to friends. Somebody who is out to get your kids, when you give them a boundary and you say, hey, I saw this thing, it doesn't really line up with what we do here at the church, so please don't do this again. Easy example is I had my very first year of being in ministry, I had a gentleman who was teaching elementary kids, and he said a pretty casual, light word, but it's not found in scripture, but it was definitely harsher than anything that we say to our kids. And I said, hey, I got a report that you said this. Let's not do that anymore. That's not something we're gonna do with our kids here, and you don't need to do that ever again. The next Sunday, he said it again. And it was casual, and he was trying to explain this other thing, and it just doesn't work. That's not in the curriculum. That's not in scripture. Let's not say it. And that was a one chance. You're gone. Like, if you're going to push boundaries, you can't serve in this ministry, because somebody who's going to push boundaries isn't going to be limited to just the words they use. But what other boundaries will he push? And so your awesome volunteers, if you set guidelines, they're going to fall within those guidelines. Easy way to tell. So top five reasons why any church ends up in court. This is true year after year after year. It is sexual abuse of a minor. This actually continues. I just haven't updated this graphic, but the last 5 years, the number one reason that a church is going to be in court is for abuse. All the other things come in a very light second, third, fourth, fifth place, but predominantly those stories are not going away, and we're trying to make them go away. That is the purpose. The reason ECAP got founded was because in 2019, the Houston Chronicle debuted three articles that were the abuse of faith against the Southern Baptist Convention. And from that, a guy named Jeff Dalrymple had this idea of, hey, we want to take the church's name out of these newspapers for this reason. We want to put the church's name for good reasons, but we want to take that out. And so what can we do? And so ECAP was created to really raise the bar for church safety. And so we've created these national standards for church safety that we want to highlight, and we give them away for free on our website. It's ecap.net. Every single standard that I'm going to share with you today, every indicator is completely free. Now, If you raise the bar up at your church and you say, hey, we do these things, we want you to be accredited, and we want you to be a member and come be part of this with us and let us promote you as, when I move to Chattanooga, I can go to ECAP and say, what are the safe churches near me? And these churches that have risen to this new standard would show up. But we want the church's name out of the newspapers for sexual abuse. Sexual abuse is really going to be this list of things right here. This is anything that's done with a kid. And so these are some of the things, these are the hard topics to talk about. But this is what we're talking about when we say that a child has been sexually abused, that there's both penetrative and non-penetrative. It's even just showing images to a child, or it's talking about this with them. This is something that goes, this is outside of the norm for talking with kids, and we reserve all of that to the discretion of the parents anyway. And so all of this would be considered sexual abuse. Physical indicators of this, and you can read this list here, and I'll share a story with you. But I had a lady who called me from a whole other town. She knew my sister-in-law. It's kind of a friend of a friend thing. She calls and says, hey, we have this girl who showed up at VBS. She's not part of our church normally, but she only wants to sit in guys' laps. And she's touching herself. And then she had 3 accidents. And she's being really sexually suggestive with these dolls. I just need to know, is that probable cause for calling this in? And I said, you have at least 4 red flags. Absolutely, you have to call this in. You're a mandatory reporter. You're in Texas. And so she really just kind of balked. She goes, but I don't want to offend the family. And I said, well, if the family has been offensive, don't you want to combat that? You're a mandatory reporter. You see these signs. Your volunteers are asking questions. Who else is going to stand up for this girl? Like, you have to do this. And so these physical indicators are just things that we can see that clue us into maybe something else is going on. One thing by themselves, maybe not, right? Depends on which one of these. But the progression of these and the combination of these absolutely should raise the hair on your neck, and it should say, hey, there's something else going on here. Grooming is where an adult is trying to get in access to kids. And so really a groomer doesn't only groom kids, they groom adults also, right? This is somebody who's trying to get access. They're going to do everything right. They're going to be this model person because they haven't been given boundaries yet. And so they're trying to get access to kids. And so what they do is for the kids, they're really looking at who are the kids who seem to be on the fringe? Who are the ones sitting out on the playground? Who are the youth who maybe leave the group earlier than the rest of them do? That they're going after easy targets. They want to gain access, and then they want to isolate. This is, again, they're not pushing them back into the crowd of friends. That's they want to carve them off, and then they're going to build trust. They're going to have secrets. They're going to have something that's just known between the two of them. And then for teens especially, this is going to be really hard to recognize because the older you get, the more that you have this kind of one-on-one. And so we're going to talk about what that looks like. But the older the kids get, the harder this is to really see. But it's why we need to be alert, and it's why we need to have multiple fences in place to protect our flocks. So be alert for signs that your teen has a relationship with an adult that includes secrecy, undue influence or control, or pushes personal boundaries. This is becoming a huge deal in online gaming. Online gaming, somebody will enter into a game, offer gifts, and offer, hey, this literally happened in my house 3 weeks ago. My son said, yeah, this guy just gave me this really cool armor in this game. And I was like, wait, you don't have access to outside stuff. This is for you and your 3 friends to do. Since when do you have outsiders coming in? And then when we looked at it, it was innocent enough because it was so early, but it was because we have this open conversation of how things are going. And so somebody had given this gift, and it's just a telltale indicator. Well, that game no longer exists in my house. Really sorry, man. That's not a possibility. You are only allowed to play in a locked game, and you unlocked it to the world, and the world came in. This is what we're talking about. It will find you, not just you going and finding it, right? So all of that to say, who are we looking for here? How do we stop them? So raise your hand if you do background checks at your church. Fantastic. I just heard a statistic this week that is 40% of churches don't even do background checks. That's a wild number to me. Background checks to me is the bare minimum that you can do. The problem with background checks, the biggest problem, and I do them. I do background checks on every volunteer who comes in. But the problem with that is that a background check only shows you what somebody has been busted for, right? So 90% of perpetrators have a clean background. So running a background check on somebody only tells you if they've been caught, not what they've actually done. And so what we want to do is change this idea that background checks are the thing that protects us, because they're not. They're a good thing to have, and they will definitely tell you who's in your church, and they're useful, but they are not the thing that we need to rely on. So relying on would be, the things that we rely on would be all of these other indicators that we're going to get into. So what we want to prevent is kids who have this long-term physical, academic, social, psychological, and spiritual effects. What we also want to do is, while we're protecting kids, we also want to protect the adults who are watching these kids. And then we also want to protect the church. Right, so this is, all three are in mind here, but the kid is absolutely our focus here. And residually, when we bolster up, when we improve the safety protocols at our church, we're going to protect both the church and the adults who are serving in it. So here's a couple of things that we have heard often. I'll say that the church is safe. Abuse doesn't happen in our church. Maybe it's too small. Right? No, everybody knows everybody at this church. That's awesome. That's great. And yet, is that really the thing that we're going to rely on? When you take that to court, do you have anything that the court can say, hey, what evidence do you have of this person having gone through a training that they were qualified to be with kids? What evidence do you have? If your evidence is we're a small church, we know them, well, clearly you don't. This thing happened. That hurts the church. That hurts the witness of the church. And so what do we do with that? We also hear perpetrators are strangers. We just knocked that one out. 7% are. 7%. You can't trust all reports of abuse. I get that. Some things turn out to be this false allegation. But we have to look at it seriously. And we have to say, hey, if this person is lying, we'll deal with that when we get there. Until then, we're going to treat it real serious, and we're going to listen to this, and we're going to look into this, and we're going to have others look into this. And then all abusers are men. Absolutely not true. But I think that we hear that, and that's where, if we took a poll, it's probably where we land. But there's a long, long list of women who have also been convicted of abuse. So we know everybody, these are common objections. We want to welcome everyone and get them to serving. Sunday's coming. We got spots to fill. My pastor, when I first came on board in ministry, my pastor said, hey, we need volunteers. And so if you're a warm body, we need you. Well, we do three services. He said that at the first one. He did not say that at the next two, right? I went up to him immediately and said, that is not accurate and that is not true. You have kids in the ministry. Why would you want a warm body in there? We don't need people. We want people, and we want the right people. And so when we get desperate and we allow anybody in, that's exactly what a perpetrator is looking for. So my sister-in-law, who I would not hire as a volunteer in my church, went to another church, and the second week she was there, she was holding somebody's baby. And I was like, oh, man, can I make a phone call? That is terrifying to me, because I know you, and you shouldn't be doing that. You don't love Jesus. You just went and tried out the church, and they said, hey, come in. We can't have that. So that's what we're trying to prevent. So prevention is a matter of biblical stewardship. The whole world is watching. What are we going to do about this? What is the church going to do? So what ECAP has done, and so now we'll kind of get into the nitty-gritty of this, but what ECAP has done is we have identified these 73 different indicators, 73 things that the church should consider as they're adopting a children's ministry program and as they're improving a kids' ministry program, and I'll say youth minor program, right? But these 73 things, they're grouped into these five categories. Talking about governance, is your nonprofit enough to stand on? Does it have documentation to just show that it really is legitimate? So when you go to court, what we want to do is just help you with bolstering that. Do y'all have minutes of leadership meetings, things like that? Screening workers and then training them. What are your operations, policy and procedures? And then what's your response plan? This is something that you want to create when it's calm, not chaos. Because in chaos, you can turn to the thing that you created when it was calm. And so this response plan is critical. So here's some of the things we look for. Basic board governance. This is a commitment from leadership. Who is leadership? Are they identified? Identifying a child safety coordinator, just somebody who's going to really pilot this and own this. They're not in charge of all things. We're going to build a team around that person, but just somebody who can spearhead it, somebody who sits at the table who can say, hey, these are the updates. This is how we're keeping our kids safe, and this is what we need from leadership to be able to back that up. A code of conduct and then an annual review. All of these things are part of governing the church that, again, if something were to happen, we want to make sure that the church can stand on its own and not just crumble under the laws that are regulated. So now we'll get into screening. This is going to get a lot more nitty-gritty for most of us. We're going to get into the meat of the ministry parts in screening. So just, I guess, quick show of hands. How many of you have your volunteers fill out an application almost like a job before they can serve in the ministry? All right, I'll go 50% on that. How many of you have a waiting period where you say, hey, you have to be part of the church, and that can be defined in different ways, part of the church for maybe 6 months before you can be part of the ministry? How many of y'all have that? All right, we're getting there, that's great. How many of you do personal interviews with each volunteer before they come in? Okay, maybe a little less. And then how many, this is the tough one, how many of you do reference checks on the person who's coming in? Yeah, usually very few. That's great. Fantastic. Reference checks are some of the hardest things. There are ways to automate that, and we want to be able to help with that. But there are ways that automate where when the person applies and that application can do so many great things for you. When they apply, the email of their references can automatically be sent. It's only a few questions. Keep your reference checks to a few questions, and they can be multiple choice of, do you think this person should serve in kids? Do you know of anything in their history that would prevent them from now serving with kids? Things like that. We all run background checks. That's awesome. And a zero tolerance. So zero tolerance is if you have been accused, convicted, if you have abuse in, like you've been, you have abused in your past, you are not allowed to serve in kids ministry. That is something that is so critical. The way I phrase this is that there is, eternal forgiveness, right? You can have done something when you were 20 that you're deeply regret for the rest of your life. There is eternal forgiveness for that, and there are earthly consequences. And so, if you have, abused somebody in the past, you are not allowed to work it with kids, period, for the rest of your life. That seems really harsh, but that is the number one indicator that more abuse is going to happen. And so anyone who is in that situation and truly has a changed heart will say, I get it. That's off limits for me. I'll go over here and I'll help with worship. I'll open doors. I'll usher, things like that. They'll have an understanding of that if they have a changed heart. Training. So all workers get trained before they get access to kids. They're trained in not just your policies and procedures. Here's how we do restroom breaks. Here's classroom ratios. Here's check-in, check-out procedures, things like that. But they're also going to be trained on recognizing signs of abuse, how to report this to church leadership, to the state, whether or not they're a mandatory reporter. All depends on what state you're in. So this training is really critical. And something that I did at my church in Texas, I just moved to Oregon, but the church in Texas, we opened the abuse awareness training up to the entire church. And we basically told the church, hey, we've raised the bar for our safety standards, and y'all have supported us in that. We believe that the training for our volunteers doesn't need to be left with our volunteers, because each one of you are out in the world, you're at a grocery store, you're on the soccer field, you're at a school function, and if we want you to be aware and you to be able to recognize signs of abuse. And so join us in this and come be part of that if you'd like. And if you want to know what that looks like, and if you want to know how to respond so that it takes, we put light into a dark place, we're going to start naming some things. man, the response from the church was incredible to say, I'll be there. And people who don't serve with kids still don't serve with kids. Some people after that go, oh yeah, is that all that is? Okay, I'm in, let's go. So you can gain volunteers from that, but really we just wanted to open the church's eyes. And we wanted to say, hey, each one of us are out in the community. We should know what to do. And as I tell my wife, these are conversations that I need you to have, but I wish you didn't need to have them. But you need to be aware of these things because this is the world we live in. I just wish it wasn't. So operations. So this is policies, procedures, things like that. This is access control. If you have a volunteer, if a plumber has to come in and you run a school out of your church, who does he have access to kids? Is he in the same hallway with kids? Who is he? When he leaves, do you know who that was and what his company was? So access control can also apply toward check-in, check-out on the weekend services, right? When a kid gets checked in, who's allowed to check them out? If it's just a parent, any parent, okay, what about the parent who doesn't have legal rights, but they're still a parent? When that dad shows up and that kid walks by and he goes, hi, dad, but that's not dad's day, can he still pick him up? Or do you have a security tag that only the person with a security tag can pick him up? See, there, it gets really complicated really quick. And so you need to think through these things. One of the beauties of ECAP to me is that we're not telling you how to do things. We're not trying to stifle the ministry in your church. What we want to do is watch it flourish because you've thought through what the policies are for your circumstance and your context. We don't say this is what you have to do. We say you have to do something about this. And so worker minor ratios, pretty self-explanatory. You should Google your state guidelines on ratios, by the way. It's wild, 24 kids for one adult and things like that. Don't do that. Don't do 24 adults, or don't do 24 kids with one adult. Never a good idea. How do you communicate with parents? What's your technology look like when you're transporting kids? What does that look like? What about camps and overnights? Do you have separate rules that govern how you do camp and how you do overnight and how you do transportation? Those are different than your normal rhythm of flow weekend services. And so what do those look like? But those all those things are how you operate. And then your response plan is going to be much more about, again, making this plan when it's calm. And so what are the laws that you need to know about? This is what I would call more behind the scenes, right? This is behind the curtain. You're going to have a plan that if something were to happen, you get to turn to this document, set it on the table and say, we said a long time ago, if something were to happen, here's who we contact. So I'll go through these real quick. Documented response plan, having a response team, how do you care for the person, and then who do we call for help? Who are those people? I'm going to call insurance. I'm going to call a lawyer. I'm going to call the police. I've got these three. I'm going to call a counselor. How do you care for the person who has been abused? How do you care for the family of the person who's been abused? How do you care for the abuser? That's one that's often overlooked, but that's real. It's going to look very different than how you care for the individual who got abused. We had, at my church, we had a guy who had been on To Catch a Predator. And I don't know if y'all know that show, but basically it was a sting operation show. This guy was on there. He solicited a minor, went to jail for it, came to our church and said, hey, I have a changed heart. I want to be here. He was not allowed in the kids ministry. He had three kids of his own. He was allowed to bring the kids into the lobby. He had a shadow who would take them, check them in, give him the security code. The shadow would walk the kids to the classrooms. He never was to step foot in the kids ministry. That shadow, when they came back, gave him a security tag. He would go to church. That shadow kind of stayed with him throughout the morning. He came back. The shadow went, picked up kids, brought him back to the lobby. If he ever broke one single rule, he was not allowed back at our church. But we cared for him for years, I think 6 or 7 years, and he followed every guideline we gave him. What a beautiful story of redemption there with a really troubled past. But God works, and he does amazing things, but we have eternal salvation, and we have earthly consequences for our actions. And that's just an easy way to say our response plan was, how do we care for this person in this moment? So here's just a quick note. These are things to think about. Does your church have a code of conduct? Have your policies been read over by just more than the children's minister? Do we have a group of people who would look at this and say, oh man, I don't see any blind spots? Or do we definitionally need somebody to say, I think you missed something here? What types of training do you give? And then again, camps and overnight, and then a safety team integration. Does your kids' ministry work with safety? Are they on the same page? If a fire were to break out, does the safety team think about one thing and the kids' ministry thinks about another thing? Or is this all one big picture? This is really what we're trying to do, is help the church function even better. And so what we do is we try to build capacity. And so the way I like to think of this is, as a minister and as pastors, we think about the church. At ECAP, we think about abuse prevention. And so while you continue to focus on the ministry, let us think about this. We can build capacity because we can say, we want to link arms with you and really join in to fight this. And so we can build capacity by you not having to focus on anything other than your job. We have an initial assessment when you come in. We'll take a look at policies and procedures, and we'll just say, hey, here's the things that we see that are missing. And then we have response plan coaching. We'll help with policy writing, and then response indicators as well. The ask here is that you would go to the website, that you would download the ECAP standards, 100% free. Use them to guide the conversations that you're going to have to make changes in your ministry. If you need more resources, we have so many videos, articles, links that are part of membership. Membership is so cheap because we're not in this to make money. We're in this to strengthen the church, but we do have a few bills that we need to pay. And so membership comes with just a really small fee, and membership is based on church size. And so this isn't a one-size-fits-all kind of a thing. But when we created the standards, our goal was to say, this: whatever we hand out for indicators, it needs to be applicable for a church of 100 and a church of 10,000. Both churches can use this. And so all that is there. And then just come join us. So I think I might have actually hit my time of 30 minutes. I can't believe it. That is the fastest I've ever done the presentation. But I want to open it up for Q&A. Because I know that there's this is really fast, and there are just so many things that are particulars. What about this thing? Or how do you overcome this? I'll take any of it. Yes, sir.
I have a lot, but I'm just
going to start with two, and then we'll see what everybody else says.
Background: I'm the head of school at a small PCA school, and it's a ministry of the church, but has its own board, and it's trying to be separate, but it's kind of not. And it's not legally a school.
Okay.
So
I won't ask any questions.
I've only been there since September. Anyways, I'll get back to it. So, one, when I got there, they have very little safety procedures. And when bringing them up with the board, the question was said, well, safety is a bar that is infinite. And so we can plan for everything under the sun, but you know, that's just going to be all we do.
Sure.
So we need to just focus on what we can do and not worry about the ifs. My first question is, how do you convince people like my board that some basic safety features are important? And then my second question is I'm technically the only employee of the school. We have stipend teachers. So a lot of the things here, it feels overwhelming to
team. Okay, yeah, safety coordinator.
I am the person.
Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah.
Like, how do you adapt?
Yeah, great question. So let me just kind of recap that. So you're at a school, particularly. You've got a governing board that's kind of getting a little bit of pushback on creating too many hoops to jump through that we talked about earlier, and that seems to be infinite, kind of difficult to attain. And then how do you get people on board? Let me address a couple things. One, I agree, it's infinite. We would say that there is no perfect program. Absolutely recognize that. And even inside of there is no perfect program, when a predator is coming along — these are questions I think you can ask your board — if a predator were to come along and he sees these three schools on the street, what makes us more difficult to get into than others? When you go back to that number one reason that the church is in a court, it's because of abuse. The average payout is $275,000. Are y'all prepared for that? Or would y'all rather spend a few thousand dollars bolstering up a couple of things here and there? You know, so when you start putting money on the table and you say, hey, are we prepared to have a payout and the name that gets run through the mud in the news, or would we like to strengthen our walls, fortify our walls, and do something about this preemptively? I think, and then if you're going to be the service coordinator, you say, I would like to spearhead this. I just need 3 or 4 people to join me in this. Who do we know? Do we have somebody who can speak on behalf of abuse? Do we have somebody who's in the counseling world? Can I get a pastor or a leader on staff to come be part of this team? They have to do very minimal. I'll lead the way, but I need some support. And so if you can get them to answer just a few of those questions, that's where I start. But I will tell you the number, let's do this. How many people in this room work in a kids or youth ministry? Okay, how many people in this room are the lead pastor or executive pastor or whatever that is called in your church? Okay, so just for the record and for the microphone, 2 of the 30 people in here are on an executive leadership place. 1, thank y'all for being here. That's incredibly uncommon to have anybody in here, and it's telling, right? The people who are typically most concerned about this are the ones on the ground in there with the kids, in the kids ministry. The ones typically who say, okay, that's great, just make sure you go take care of it, are typically the ones that make the decisions and ultimately write the checks, right? And so what we want to do is ask those questions to the church and encourage the church to ask questions to the leadership and say, hey, wouldn't you want to be on the other side of this? Wouldn't you want to be part of the preventing abuse and not trying to control the PR that comes after abuse? So, does that help?
Yes. It can be a long term.
Yeah, I'll give you my card. We can talk. Yes, ma'am. Yes. It is. So we ran 3 services. That person would always attend service. They were part of our security team, but they would always attend the same service. And so one of the stipulations was he couldn't pick which service he came to. He could. He could say, hey, 11 o'clock really works for me. Awesome. From here on out, it's 11 o'clock, and it can't be different. You can't show up at 8 o'clock because we're not going to have your shadow here at 8 o'clock. But that shadow then went to service at 11 o'clock, and they just sat, you know, one row behind him. They actually ended up basically having fellowship and being in each other's lives until the guy moved away. But it actually turned out to be a really beautiful thing. But typically, it's somebody who is into security and following rules and just sees the bigger picture of things. But that's a great question. I don't have a specific protocol for finding that person. Just pray, God bring me a person. Yes, ma'am.
I had a question. Small groups. I can see it on your list of places.
Yeah.
Home groups.
That's right.
How do you advise people in that regard? I know of a specific instance in a friend of ours' church that had an abuse situation. Because she was a social worker, she was a mandatory reporter. Mm-hmm. So that ended up in a whole thing. So can you say to that?
Yeah. So it is one of our indicators. I will also tell you, I believe this is the grayest area that the church has right now. And so there's 2 real conflicting thoughts from lawyers that are happening right now, and we're going to kind of see where they land. But one thought is small groups that meet in homes, especially, like if they meet at the church, it's obviously a church function. Some lawyers would say that when a community group meets and it's off-site, that it's not a function of the church, and so the church shouldn't have to think about it. Do that what you will. Others would say, no, that's absolutely a function of the church because it's all church members and we encourage people to be in community group. And if something were to happen, that actually is a reflection of the church. And so ECAP will, in my official ECAP capacity, I will tell you that we encourage you to think through that and have a plan for that. In my, hey, let's just talk on the side and we can be friends and share some of this. Anyone who's working with your kids should be a known individual. There should be parameters inside of every house. Now, as a church, that might be difficult to say, here are the parameters. But I think there's a baseline set of parameters that should happen. There should never be an adult or a teenager, often is who this is, adult or teen with a child. Now, it's actually remarkably hard to be alone with a child. We live in a world where there's a lot of people, and in community groups where there are a lot of kids, And so it should never be that there is a one-on-one, but a one teenager with five kids, that doesn't break that rule. And so do you need two? That's your choice. But I would say the ultimate rule is there is no one-on-one contact, period. Now, when that, because I said we would talk about a little bit of how that looks for youth specifically. In a youth ministry, I would say the danger is also don't have one-on-one texting conversations or messaging conversations. We encourage we require our youth leaders that if a student texts you, loop in somebody else on the response. And so you can always throw me on a text. I probably won't read the majority of them, but you can always say, hey, I included Jeremy here just in case there's any other questions. And I'm on every other text that comes through there, because anytime a student texts one-on-one, I want to make sure that our workers are being responsible and not being one-on-one in a digital world, because they can't be one-on-one in the physical world. But for community group, I would just say that the church can set basic parameters. Don't be alone with a child. I think the church has discretion to say, and maybe each home group has discretion to say, hey, when you're diapering a child, come get a parent. We're downstairs, hopefully, right? It's not offsite. But we're right here, and you're welcome to come get us on that. That doesn't bother us at all, things like that. But I would say the church needs to set up baseline rules. I think this is where the church is going to be hurt the most over time, because we don't think about that. So it is one of our indicators. It's one of our 73 things that we say, you need to think about this and you need to have rules on this. Yeah, I'm going to go ladies first. Go for it.
This is kind of specific. When two people are serving together in the nursery and children's church, do you usually advise that those people are not related? Because usually,
great question.
Husband and wife that like to serve together, like me and my teenage son would like to serve together. Do you usually say no to that?
Yeah, so can two related people serve together? And it's just the two of them, right? Not a third person. I'll answer that with a question. Do you have a camera in the room?
No.
Okay, if there's not a camera in the room, I might suggest that they don't. Cameras have gotten really cheap, and storage has gotten really cheap. I highly, 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 highly recommend cameras in the classrooms, because that's your ultimate witness. And now the husband and wife can absolutely serve together, because that thing doesn't lie up there in the ceiling. It tells the truth every single time. There's no cover-up. And so if that's in the camera, absolutely. Husband and wife, I want you to serve together. I want you to be able to go home and talk about what happened in a classroom. And, I love it when newlyweds get to serve together, especially in infants. Like, oh, you think that's how you change a diaper? You know, like, those things are beautiful conversations to have. And so if there's a camera in the room, no question, go for it. But get a camera there. Also, you have to do your own research on this, but the federal government will give you money to improve safety in your church for free. It's not a grant. Sorry. It's not a loan. It is a grant. It is, here's money. Go buy walkie-talkies, cameras, vests for your parking lot, cones, all sorts of things, and they'll give that away every single year. So you have to look into that. Yes, sir.
Yes.
Google. It's complicated. It's more complicated than I have here. I have an email that a friend sent me that he has been using at his church, and I'm like, oh, that's incredible. That is the extent of my knowledge, but the Google machine will definitely tell you more about that. Yeah.
We have a mentality that might be in everybody's church where if an adult is going to be around a group of kids, like say VBS, and you're working in the check-in desk, and they're not going to be anywhere else, there's a mentality, well, we don't need to do all the background check and all that.
So basically you have volunteers who don't directly work with kids, but they work in kids ministry. I couldn't stress strongly enough to everybody gets the same treatment, no matter which position you fill. We ended up taking our safety standards and really the screening process to other ministries as well, because then people can move from one ministry to another inside the church. And they might get trained differently in the kids than they would if they were on the AV team, but we want to know who's in the AV team. And so we had them fill out the same application for anybody who works in the church, volunteer or paid.
Even for a week, like VBS, but not in reference to kids.
Yeah, even if. It happens more often than you think that somebody sees the opportunity to go in at a VBS. So, yeah, I know it's a lot of extra work for that one time, but the prayer is once you're in, man, you've already been through this whole screening process. Why don't you jump in on Sunday mornings? Come be part of this.
And when we baptize infants and we all stand and say, I will help raise this child in the church, you also know
yes. Love that.
So.
Love that. That's fantastic. I'm stealing that line 100%. Love it. Yes, sir.
I have a two-parter. Returning back to your comment about the cameras for the first part, how do you address technophobia? I.e., one could make the argument by putting all of the surveillance systems in the church, aren't we heightening the sense of danger?
Yeah.
Also, going back to this gentleman made the comment, I think it was a good point that there's often this concern or a dismissiveness that results from a lack of measurable or incremental success in this department. What is the limit to how much safety procedures and protocols we can implement? So how would you suggest that we implement meaningful but still incremental and measured and attainable change?
Great.
That's a very broad question.
Yeah. Let me address the first one. The first one is if we put cameras in the rooms, aren't we just kind of heightening the sense of paranoia maybe, or you're almost thinking about this too much, which actually kind of relates to the second question, I guess. But I would say I've been in ministry for a little over a decade. We've had cameras for just about that long. I've pulled up cameras 3 times. None of them were for abuse. They were all just to see what happened here. Like, this is a learning opportunity for us. And so I had a mom, the first one, which is my favorite one, mom came to me and she said, I believe that your volunteers spilled hot coffee on my kid. I was like, I heard nothing about this. Let's go check it out. And so we pulled up the video. I pulled up the video, skimmed through it, found where the one instance was, but the volunteer had Starbucks and they were in there with infants and they did a great job of picking up the Starbucks every time a kid was about to crawl through, except one time. The kid knocked it over. The volunteer pulled the kid back. There was no coffee on that child. They guarded that area, cleaned it up as best as they could with what they had. And then a couple of minutes later, the kid who was in question crawled through it. Well, they had coffee on their clothes. Doesn't mean they had coffee spilled on the child. And so what do we learn from that? Well, leave your Starbucks either up on this shelf, which is why the shelf is here. What a beautiful thing to show. Man, our volunteers do such a great job. And so each time was actually more of a learning component than it was a fear component. And so that would be my encouragement, is to use the cameras as training in those moments where it's possible. Can you remind me your second question?
How do we, I think, especially like Presbyterian-minded sessions and leadership circles, the shock and awe factor of abuse is actually not as persuasive, because we're like, yeah, we agree, how do we do it? And what does that look like? And it's tempting to just throw up our hands and say, well,
there's too many things.
Yeah. So what are like the best measurable steps forward? And for context, I suppose, like, we mainly just go back. We don't do much.
Yeah, so I would say if you go download these 73 things completely free, right? ECAP.net, download them, and then just, you could go through with a pink, yellow, and green highlighter and say, these are things we don't even consider, right? There's a list of 73 things. These are things we don't even consider. We don't have an idea about. Here's the things that we kind of have an idea about, but it's kind of outdated, or we probably ought to think through that a little more, and these are the things we do really well. If you highlight most of the things green, praise God, that's awesome. If your document is mostly red, I think that's really a beautiful picture of like, hey, we need to think about this because this is the world we live in. We don't need to put our head in the sand and we don't need to just say, well, it's unattainable, so we're not even going to try. Well, it's absolutely attainable. You can build really strong walls. Is there a perfect system? Absolutely not. Every year, so when we audit a church and say, hey, do you really do the things that you say that you're doing? We audit them, and at the end of the audit, it is the improvement plan. That will be forever. Every single year, we can adjust and tweak something, and we see, oh, man, this thing still has a gap in it. Let's see what we can do to make this better. So is it ever attainable to have a 100% safe place? No. Are there steps you can take in the right direction that make you a safe church? Absolutely there are. And so I would recommend that colorful exercise. Did you like that? Thank you. Appreciate it. I work with kids. Yes, sir.
All of those documents, are there sample worker applications, interview questions?
There are. They're on the member side of things. That exact thing, so like a example policy and procedure, example code of conduct, example application, example response plan, all that is available on the other side of it. And so that's kind of our, hey, if you're in, we want to just shower you with what you need. And so, yes, absolutely available. I think that's my time. I'm going to stick around for here. Thank you all so much for coming in. Can I just pray for us? God, I thank you for the people who came here. I thank you for the churches that they represent. I pray for them to have clarity and peace of mind, knowing that you're sovereign, but we still have a job to do. And that in Ephesians 2:10, you say that you've given us this gift of salvation, but that we were created for good works in Christ Jesus, that we would walk in these things that you've laid out from before the beginning of time. And so would you help us to walk through them well? God, would you be with us and surround us with people who would also see that this is a good and right and necessary thing, and that for eternity we won't need this in this fallen world. We do. So be gracious with us. In your name I pray. Amen. Thank y'all.